Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Cystinuria is a rare kidney stone disorder that affects 1 in 10,000 individuals in the United States. Given its relative infrequency, clinicians may not be well-versed in the American Neurologic Association guidelines for kidney stones, specifically as it relates to cystinuria and the unique pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic treatment options of the disease state. Today, my colleague, Dr. Sarah Steven, a clinical pharmacist at Mayo Clinic Specialty Pharmacy, reviews cystinuria treatment options, as well as outlines how to manage side effects that may occur with the use of cystinuria medication therapy.
So today our objectives are to review the pathophysiology of the disease of cystinuria. We're going to walk through describing the non-pharmacologic and pharmacologic treatment options for this disease, and also review the potential side effects of the pharmacologic treatment options and how to manage those. So cystinuria is a rare kidney stone disorder as designated by the National Organization for Rare Diseases, or NORD. It occurs in 1 per 10,000 people in the U.S. population, and there is higher incidence found in some European countries. It affects males and females equally, and the symptoms can start presenting between the age of 10 to 30 years, not to say that there aren't some outliers of much younger children or much more older adults that may experience their first stone. So this disease stems from a mutation in the SLC7A9 or the SLC3A1 genes. This causes a defect in the protein that is required for dibasic amino acid transport in the renal proximal tubules. This causes an issue with reabsorption of cystine, leading to accumulation of cystine in the urinary tract. And this can be a total inability to reabsorb cystine or a reduced ability to reabsorb the cystine. The cystine molecules then bind, creating cystine crystals, and continue to bind further molecules growing into sizable stones. Cystine itself is highly insoluble in urine at a normal physiologic pH. So these stones can grow quite large, anywhere from 1 centimeter to taking up the entire space of the kidney and requiring a kidney removal, or they can grow in large quantities of hundreds of small stones. Some patients will start collections of all the stones that they have removed and passed, and they can number quite significantly. These stones, of course, can cause significant problems, leading to hydronephrosis, severe pain, nausea and vomiting, hematuria, urinary tract infections if there is cause of urinary retention or blockage in the urinary tract by these stones. And in rare cases, it can lead to chronic or acute renal failure. So if you would like to pull up your poll everywhere, either on your phone or tablet or through the web address, let's do a question. So cystine kidney stones are formed by A, overproduction of cystine by improper methionine breakdown, B, a defect in dibasic amino acid transport in the renal proximal tubules, C, accumulation of cystine and formation of cystine crystals, or D, bacterial infection reducing cystine solubility, or is it E, a combination of B and C? So the correct answer for this question is E, both B and C. The cystine kidney stones are caused by this defect in the dibasic amino acid transport in the renal proximal tubules and the accumulation of cystine and formation of those cystine crystals. It is not caused by overproduction of cystine by improper methionine breakdown, and it's not caused by any kind of bacterial infection. Unique challenges with this rare disease include fluctuations that are possible in the cystine levels, urinary pH, urinary volume, also the inconvenience of monitoring for efficacy of treatment of this disease. Patients usually have to use a 24-hour urine collection kit, which involves them collecting all of their urine voided for a full 24-hour period, which for most patients is difficult to do outside of the home, limiting their outside of home activities for the day that they have assigned to that. Also, stone visibility on imaging can be challenging. These stones don't necessarily show up on X-ray as a calcium stone may show up a little better. These stones are better viewed by ultrasound or CT scan. And unfortunately for patients presenting with stone pain in the emergency room, sometimes this can be overlooked and they can be accused of pain medication seeking behavior because the stone cannot be seen if a basic X-ray is performed. Also, there are frequent surgical interventions required for these patients because of the size or quantity of stones that may grow for them, leading, of course, to miss work, school, any general activities, recovery times, and then medical bills on top of everything else. So in treating these type of patients, our goals of disease management, we definitely want to improve their quality of life. And we do that in several different ways. First and foremost, reducing pain. We want to prevent these stone events to reduce episodes of stone pain and reduce episodes of renal colic caused by this constant inflammation in the kidney. We want to decrease their stone burden to help maintain their kidney function. And we really want to prevent surgical intervention for all the reasons that I previously mentioned. The American Urological Association guidelines do have treatment recommendations for cystinuria. There's first line and then second line treatments. First line therapy would be a massive fluid intake goal per day. These patients need to try to achieve 4 liters of fluid per day. We also want to have dietary sodium restrictions and limit their animal protein consumption. We're looking for a goal urine pH of around 7.0. If those methods are ineffective at controlling the rate and development of stones, then we move into other pharmacologic options, including tiopronin, which according to the AUA is recommended as first, and then D-penicillamine if that's not effective. Fluid intake for reference for the average person is about 2 liters a day. So diving more deeper into the fluid intake goals, ideally we want this 4 liters of fluid that they're consuming to be water, which as you can imagine for most patients can be very difficult. We say water because any other fluids that they're intaking can have an impact on their urine pH. The goal behind this increasing of the urine volume, we want to decrease that concentration of cysteine so that we can reduce the amount of stones that are then formed. The patients have to have consistent large fluid intake. They can't say, well, I'm going to drink 2 liters in the morning and 2 liters in the evening to get that fluid intake. It has to be spaced out throughout the day and even overnight when they wake up to void. So challenges with this, of course, is consistency. Personally, I don't believe I would be able to schedule that much drinking throughout the day. And like I mentioned, the different fluids having that impact on urine pH, not being able to go to a wedding and have a drink or maybe having to forego that cup of coffee in the morning because of the impact it has on your urine pH could be challenging. And also based on what they do for a living, the frequent need to urinate can be very troublesome if they don't have access to facilities. So dietary restrictions include reducing their sodium intake and also their animal protein. We know that reduction of sodium intake improves the alkalization of the urine. And methionine is an amino acid found in animal protein that is a known precursor of cysteine. So idea is if we can reduce that, we can hopefully reduce some of the cysteine that is then trapped in the urine. So some ways that patients may achieve this, they could follow the DASH diet, which is very well publicized for some assistance with restricting their sodium intake. Some patients may turn to vegetarian or vegan substitutes. And then, of course, consistency is an issue with this as well. Most patients don't eat the exact same food every day. And then there can be mixed guidance on this available for patients. There's no exact recommendation for animal protein consumption. There's been no definitive study that's determined an exact amount of ounces of chicken, fish, red meat in correlation with an exact amount of cysteine that would then be produced. So each patient has to individualize. So if we move into the pharmacologic options, urinary alkalizers would be our next step. We want to raise the urine pH for these patients. About a goal, like I said earlier, of about 7.0 is ideal, but for some patients it may range between 6.5 and 7.0. We do this by utilizing potassium citrate or sodium bicarbonate are some good options. We want to cause this more alkaline urine to increase that cysteine solubility and thereby reducing stone formation. We dose these medications based on the patient's normal urine pH and how they tolerate them. Some patients may experience some gastrointestinal side effects from these medications. We're going to be increasing a pill burden for these patients. Some of these medications for consistency of pH control are going to require 3 to 4 times a day dosing, which can be very inconvenient and difficult for them. And it can be a very delicate balancing act for all the reasons that I've mentioned, along with the fluids, diet, and then these medications on top of it. So if all of those options fail, we move to cysteine-binding thiol drugs with our goal of reducing cysteine concentration. If we can reduce cysteine concentration below what's called the line of solubility. So for patients with an optimized urine pH of 7.0, this would be less than 250 milligrams of cysteine per every liter of urine that they're producing. In theory, stone formation should be prevented as long as this is consistent every single day. So to achieve this reduction in cysteine concentration, we have to dose these cysteine-binding thiols based on our 24-hour urine results and the patient's tolerability. These patients will face challenges with these medications, most notably an extremely high pill burden. D-penicillamine is available as a 250-milligram tablet, dosed at 1 to 4 grams per day in 4 divided doses, so a pill burden of 4 to 16 tablets per day in addition to their urinary alkalizer. Tiapronin is available as a 100-milligram tablet, and it's dosed at 800 milligrams to 3,000 milligrams a day in 3 divided doses, with a pill burden of anywhere from 8 to 30 tablets a day. So side effects from these medications can also be extremely treatment limiting. And when a patient starts on these type of medications, they're going to need frequent monitoring of their urinary values, their blood levels, and dose adjustments may be necessary, especially early in treatment. So, delving into a little more detail on treatment side effects. For urinary alkalizers, potassium citrate is noted to be the potential cause of gastrointestinal upset, can also cause hyperkalemia in some patients, so they need to have their potassium levels monitored. Sodium bicarbonate can be responsible for bloating, gas, metabolic abnormalities, and possibly edema in some patients. And then, of course, there is the potential for urine to become too alkaline, which could increase the patient's risk of other types of calcium stones. Unfortunately, some patients will run into this issue where they end up having these hybrid stones of both cysteine and calcium or other components. So I want to talk about the cysteine-binding thiol drug, D-penicillamine, first. This drug has been around longer than tiapronin. It is known for some pretty serious treatment side effects. Gastrointestinal upset can include nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, can also cause significant abdominal pain, can also cause distortion or loss of taste. Patients can experience serious dermatologic complications, including pemphigus, which would require treatment to be immediately stopped. Also, more mild to moderate skin rashes, pruritus, can cause fragile skin, hair loss, and something significant for the younger patient population, this medication can lead to skin atrophy and excessive wrinkling. Hematologic abnormalities would require treatment to be stopped. They can include leukopenia, thrombocytopenia, pancytopenia, aplastic anemia, and unfortunately, D-penicillamine has also been linked to fatal reports of agranulocytosis. And as far as a kidney disease goes, of course, we're trying to preserve kidney function, but these medications can also have renal disturbance problems where they lead to proteinuria and nephrotic syndrome. D-penicillamine requires an additional medication, a vitamin B6 supplement, And there is significant potential for dose-related toxicity. As patients go up on dose to control their stone burden, they're at greater risk of side effects. Additionally, I want to mention here that fever of various sources is possible with these medications. There is a lupus-like drug reaction, which includes fever. Fever could be due to a hematologic abnormality. And then there's also drug fever, generally listed in some of the prescribing information for these medications. So it's up to the provider, unfortunately, to try to determine what the fever may be stemming from. So as far as these side effects go, while several of them do require discontinuation of the drug for their serious nature, we need to try to manage as best as we can for these patients. For any of the GI complications a patient may experience, unfortunately, the patient may be required to take additional meds for those side effects. For the dermatologic ones, anything as severe as pemphigus, of course, would result in discontinuation of the drug, but mild to moderate symptoms may require topicals, whatever that may need for those rashes that may present for patients to tolerate. And then as far as the renal disturbances, because there are so few options for these patients, ultimately, we would want to hold the medication until this resolves, and then based on how severe it was, consider discontinuation of the drug or determine whether we try to restart at a reduced dose. So the cysteine-binding drug, tiopronin, includes all the potential side effects of D-penicillamine, but a comparative study did demonstrate that this medication may be better tolerated. One thing additional that I do want to include for tiopronin, though, is that jaundice and abnormal liver function tests have occurred rarely, so that would be an additional monitoring parameter for this drug. So let's talk about that comparative study briefly. This study was entitled Management of Cysteine Nephrolithiasis with Alpha Mercaptopropanural Glycine. This was a multi-clinic trial with 12 study sites and only 66 patients. But of course, with rare disease, patient populations are small, so this was the best that they could do. A primary objective of this was to determine the safety and efficacy of tiopronin in patients who had a known toxicity to D-penicillamine, patients who had to discontinue that drug within the last 2 years because of side effects. Their secondary objective was to determine if the responses to treatment with tiopronin were similar to those reported for D-penicillamine, if it was as effective or not. So they enrolled 49 of the 66 patients for their primary objective. The remaining patients that they enrolled for the secondary objective weren't completely treatment naive, but they were considered to be a little different. They had not taken D-penicillamine for at least 2 years prior to this study. So summary of their findings, they admitted that side effects were very common for both D-penicillamine and tiopronin. But they did determine that the adverse reactions were less severe for the patients that took the tiopronin versus what they had experienced in the past with D-penicillamine. Specifically, a significant difference, emesis and rash were found between tiopronin and D-penicillamine. And among the 34 patients with previous D-penicillamine reactions that necessitated withdrawal from treatment, they found that 22 of those could be maintained on tiopronin. Only one patient from that smaller group of 17 had to stop the tiopronin due to side effects from that drug specifically, and that was proteinuria. They also were successful in finding that tiopronin was equally effective as D-penicillamine at retarding the rate of new stone formation. So something I really want to drive home with this presentation is that these patients have very limited options. When you have a patient that's diagnosed with this disease, it's important to explain that to them. This isn't treating hypertension or diabetes where maybe we have this large pool of options to draw from. These medications will in all likelihood cause side effects and they will need to be managed. These patients also need to understand that medication side effects warrant that they are frequently monitored and that they need to have patience while the drug is incrementally increased to achieve a better quality of life and reduce stone burden for them. So each individual patient is going to need that open dialogue with their provider to make sure that they can determine if the side effects are more tolerable than the stone activity they are experiencing prior to treatment. So here is a visual of the treatment approach. If you have a patient with confirmed cystinuria, of course, starting the fluids and diet modification is very important. If you want to be more aggressive, you can also initiate a urinary alkalizer at that same time. But then if those fail, cysteine-binding thiol drugs need to be added on to these treatments, and then, of course, require frequent monitoring and management of side effects. So here's another question. So the Atkins diet, which for those of you that are not familiar with it, is a high-protein diet, would not have any impact on the stone formation rates in a cystinuria patient. Is this true or false statement? Looks like everybody's on the right track here. That is correct. This statement is false. A high protein rich diet, especially with animal protein, could drastically increase the rate of stone formation in a patient that maybe was better controlled previously on a more plant-based or balanced diet. So let's touch on the monitoring of these patients. When a patient is initially diagnosed with this and you're working through fluid intake, diet, starting these new medications, a patient log would be extremely helpful in determining how much they're drinking, what exactly they're eating, when they're taking their medications, and if they're having side effects, when are these occurring? And trying to put all that together so that you can determine the best course of treatment for these patients. We also want to track the stone development rates and size. If you have a patient that goes from developing 1 centimeter stones, they start on these treatment plans, and then they're still passing stones, but maybe now they don't have to have surgery. Maybe they're able to pass their stones effectively, or what's been described as having a sandy urine consistency. That would still be an improvement for these patients and control of the disease. It's very important to evaluate imaging on a regular basis and the patient's overall presentation and how they're feeling about their treatment for assessment of their control, in addition to what their labs may show you. So we want to make sure that a CBC and liver function testing is done on a regular basis. Blood work is recommended, especially at initiation, at 3 to 6 months after starting a cysteine-binding thiol. And of course, don't forget to monitor that potassium level if they are taking a potassium citrate. 24-hour urine collections need to be specifically ordered to measure not just volume and cysteine, but pH. And if that is not specified, unfortunately, the patient can have to redo the testing, and they will be very unhappy with you. We use these numbers to help calculate the concentration of the cysteine and determine the risk of future stone formation. Don't forget that our goal concentration is below 250 milligrams per liter at that optimized urine pH of around 7. Any kind of fluctuation in that urine pH can affect our goal concentration. And I want to make note here that the cysteine-binding thiol medications can be misleading sometimes when you're looking at these results. If you have a patient that's taking one of these medications and they do a 24-hour urine test, they may still show that their cysteine levels are higher than you would like, but if the patient shows no stones on imaging and they're not reporting any type of stone activity, then you may want to let the dosing be and just monitor the patient frequently. So let's do our last question here. You have a cystinuria patient. You've prescribed tiopronin. They've been taking it for 2 weeks now. They call in complaining of a low-grade fever. What would you recommend them to do? A, take an antipyretic and continue the treatment as prescribed. B, interrupt the therapy until the fever subsides and restart at the full dose they were previously taking. Stop therapy and give up on cysteine-binding thiol treatments. Interrupt the therapy until the fever subsides and restart at a low dosage, titrating up to the desired. It looks like people are right on track. D is the correct answer. Because of the possibility of fever being related to a hematologic issue, we wouldn't necessarily want to just tell the patient to take an antipyretic and continue treatment as prescribed. we don't necessarily want to interrupt therapy until the fever subsides and then restart back at the full dose, because in all likelihood, they are then going to have a repeat of what just happened to them with the fevers. We also, because of the limited amount of options for these medications, we don't want to stop therapy and give up on treatment entirely. We need to try to find a way to make this work, if at all possible. The best answer is D, interrupting the therapy until the fever subsides, restarting at a low dose, and titrating up. And of course, it would also be a good idea to check the blood work and make sure that there's no abnormalities noted. So the management of this disease, it can be unpredictable, which of course is very frustrating for patients. There can be fluctuations in these cysteine levels based on where they're at with their life, based on their age and what their practicing habits may be. Some of these frustrations may stem from patient behavior. So we need to emphasize treatment adherence, taking their medications, drinking their fluids, sticking to a diet plan, and making sure that they're doing all of their lab work. We really need to work on managing the side effects for these patients. And most of all, remember that for them, management of this is a marathon. It's certainly not a sprint.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.